This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up for one class of students at Lawrence University this fall, they're being evaluated on how little they can do. It's a course called Doing Nothing. We'll talk with a professor who created it with a goal of teaching students to unplug and be more present. Now, exit polling from last week's midterm elections confirmed that abortion was one of the top issues that drove voters to the polls. Voters in every state with direct ballot measures voted in favor of abortion rights, and Democrats are more broadly pointing toward the issue as a factor in some of their success on Election Day. But earlier today, President Biden said he doesn't think Democrats will end up with enough votes in Congress to pass legislation that would codify abortion access into federal law. It's clear that the issue is important to voters. Less clear what, if anything, will change nationwide and in states around the country as a result of the midterms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important was abortion in deciding your votes last week? How did you feel about broader support for abortion rights and votes around the country? What do you want to see happen in Wisconsin politics? Divided government again? Do you want to see the 1800s law overturned? If so, what do you want to see in its place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary. Her research focuses on gender, politics, and reproduction in the United States. Claire, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, coming into this election, there was this expectation, you know, midterm election with a Democrat in office, the economy, lower approval ratings for the president. Republicans were expected to gain a lot of seats in the House and maybe some in the Senate. Things didn't work out that way. How big a factor, as you start to look at post-election stuff, how big a factor do you think abortion may have been in that difference?
I think when we look at the current ecosystem of American politics with political polarization really keeping people in their camps as much as it is, all you need is a 1 or 2 point swing to change something from a Republican landslide to Democrats holding on. And that's exactly what I think abortion did. Much like before Dobbs overturned Roe v. Wade, we saw ballot initiatives that were pro-life or anti-abortion driving 1 or 2 percentage points, especially in southern states. I think that's what we saw this year, especially in states that had abortion explicitly on the ballot.
One factor I've been wondering about is the role of younger women in particular. I want to play actually a question I asked a guest 2 weeks before the midterms. Here's a listen. Over the last bunch of months since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the Dobbs decision, we've seen a few elections, a referendum in Kansas, a couple of special House elections where there was kind of a hidden phenomenon, it seemed like, in the polling of younger women in particular becoming likely voters where pollsters might not have considered them that in the past. Do you think that's something that might hold in 2 weeks? Okay, that was before the election. That was kind of an unanswerable question in some ways because we didn't know. Do we have an answer to that question about younger women voters now?
I think we definitely see a solidification of younger women voters as solidly in favor of abortion rights. And so falling into the camp of Democratic candidates. And I think that it's kind of, we'll see further in the exit polls once the results can be actually analyzed. But I think that we can be relatively certain that we saw at least a more active youth participation in the election in different jurisdictions. I know that can't hold true everywhere in the nation. But again, places where you saw people really tuned in to the possibility of abortion being newly restricted in their state, or really seeing the ramifications of electing particular politicians, you'll see youth turnout much higher in this election than you did in previous ones, especially for young women.
I want to start looking at what this means for abortion laws in the country. Let's start at the federal level. It looks like the Republicans are going to have a slight edge in the House. If I'm reading that right, I'm guessing, Claire, not much is likely to change when it comes to federal law on abortion.
I think that's exactly right. So much like in the Senate, you would need a 60 vote threshold to overcome any filibuster. So we won't see any codification movement on the Senate level. And in the House, any move to restrict abortion on the federal level would meet with that same Senate filibuster. So we may see the same sort of performative politics that we've seen in the past, where people will propose bills that will probably not even get a full hearing in either the House or the Senate. But this will remain an issue fought on the battlegrounds of local and state politics.
Then at the state level, it seems like a real mixed bag. Some direct referenda changing abortion laws in some states, some state legislatures switching to a Democratic and more likely pro-choice orientation. But then states like Florida and Ohio, where it seems like the possibility is laws could move the other way. What are some of the main things you're watching for at the state level?
I think what's most important is looking at those states that tend to swing to see whether or not we see new abortion restrictions on their books. Florida has already passed a 15-week abortion ban, and I would be shocked to see any further restrictions from Florida. But I'm really interested in seeing what will happen in states like Virginia or states like Iowa, where, you know, maybe there's some possibility of movement towards Democratic or Republicans in the next election cycle, and whether or not conservative majorities in either, you know, the governor's mansion or in either of the houses of Congress will try and restrict, or will see that as electorally risky for them.
Talking to Claire McKinney from the College of William and Mary, looking at abortion and politics, the impact that abortion issues had on the midterm elections and what the midterm elections mean for laws in states around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did this issue sway your vote one way or another? Is this an issue that brought you to the polls? Maybe for the first time, if you're one of those younger voters we were just talking about. Love to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. I had some questions. If it is allowed that a person could have an abortion who is the victim of incest, or a woman who is raped, or something, a doctor is allowed to help a woman whose life is in danger. How is that proven to be correct in the court of law? I mean, does an incest victim have to come forward, and does that have to go through a court proceeding and a government official will allow an abortion? Is that the same with a woman? What if her rapist is unknown to her and cannot be found? Will she be shamed, and will Republicans defile her her integrity for claiming to be raped?
Yordis, I gotcha. Claire, this is a question that comes up a lot when we see these rape or incest exemptions for abortion. How does it work on that practical level that Yordis was just talking about?
I think that this has a lot to do with what context somebody is in. So for the most part, I agree with, I think, the implicit suspicion in Yordis's question, which is, what would you actually have to go through in order to prove that you were a candidate to have a legal abortion? For the most part, if we think about these laws, we can think about it really in terms of, does a physician feel comfortable providing abortion care? And so the rape and incest exceptions are ones that really are about, can a physician say, I had a legitimate belief that this person was a victim of a crime, and so this is a legitimate form of care. But in states like Texas, which still have on the books this abortion bounty law, where somebody can sue an abortion provider for providing an abortion after 6 weeks, you could see that that level of suspicion would actually have a chilling effect. So in the end, we actually don't have a system, as far as I know, in any of the states, of something like a judicial fast track for somebody who is claiming rape or incest with these very restrictive laws. And that's because prior to the Dobbs decision, we didn't have any laws that were that restrictive.
Thanks for that call, Yordis, at 800-642-1234. We've got maybe a unique position here in Wisconsin, Claire. We have this law from the early 1800s still on the books here in Wisconsin, a near total ban except in cases of a threat to the life of the mother. Divided government, a Democratic governor just reelected, a Republican legislature just reelected. They don't talk with each other that much. They don't get along that well. We may just stay with this bill and coast on the inertia. Do you see other states in Wisconsin's position, or are we unique in some ways?
I think that Wisconsin is fairly unique. Divided government and an 1800 law as the one that's in effect is one that leaves a lot of uncertainty for people. And that uncertainty certainly is the case in several other states, but in many others, you either have new restrictions or you had trigger laws in place that really affirmed anti-abortion laws as the standard. And then on the flip side, you have other states where they had on the books either constitutional protections or laws in place like New York that were very clear. And the new, obviously, referenda that we saw in California and Vermont that reaffirmed many of those statuses. I think the states that will remain the most uncertain are the ones that do have divided governorships and houses or congresses, because those are the ones where we're likely to see continued uncertainty, but nothing to the degree of Wisconsin.
We're talking to College of William & Mary Government Professor Claire McKinney about the role abortion played in last week's midterm elections and what those elections will mean for abortion laws in states around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where did abortion rank for you among the most important issues in this election? Was it a decisive issue in one or more of your votes? Do you think the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and the Dobbs decision did end up helping Democrats? What do you want to see happen with federal law when it comes to abortion, with Wisconsin law when it comes to the issue? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Claire McKinney, Assistant Professor of Government at the College of William & Mary, where she researches politics and reproductive rights in the U.S. She's with us today to look at the issue of abortion, how it affected the midterm elections, what the results could mean for laws in states around the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. I want to give a listen to Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer talking about abortion and why his party exceeded expectations last week. Here's what he told MSNBC earlier today.
It stayed in the hearts of the people. You know, the commercials come on and some of them are sort of incendiary and they're the thing right at the top of people's minds when a pollster asks them about them. But abortion had always stayed as a very important issue with large numbers of people.
And Claire, there was some thought maybe up till the elections that abortion would fade in memory a little bit, I guess, since the Dobbs decision was some months ago, get bumped out by other issues. Clearly, for many people, it did persist. Why do you think that is?
I think that there are two big reasons. One is I think a lot of abortion rights and abortion rights advocates and groups were really pushing this to remain front and center in how we think about the election and the stakes of the election. Post-Dobbs, there's been a real urgency, and funding and fundraising has flowed to these organizations at unprecedented rates, and they have really been front and center in getting the message out. But the other really important issue is that abortion and access to abortion is something that people live with and part of their decision-making every day. So you could imagine if you are somebody who's trying to consider whether or not you want to start a family, or somebody is facing real material constraints on your life, that the question of whether or not you'll have access to abortion is something that affects how you think about your life every day. And so even if it's not in the headlines, if you know that you no longer have access to something that you theoretically had access to before, you may really want to act to make sure that you can transform your political and social situation in the future.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. To me, a great compromise would just be allow a woman 12 weeks to make a decision. That's plenty of time to make a decision on whether or not you're going to keep a baby or not. but also give the same right to a man. So if a man decides, I don't want to be a father within that 12 weeks, they don't have to pay child support. Make it pro-choice for men and women for the first 12 weeks.
Steve, thanks for the call. Claire, take that where you want to go with it.
I think that this is an intuition that a lot of people have. And the problem is that really we have to kind of think about why abortion is so important to determining the life chances of individuals and especially women. So while it's true that the vast majority of abortions occur in the first trimester, that is during the first, you know, prior to the first 12 weeks, there are those people who don't find out that they are pregnant until after that time. And many of those people tend to be low income or lack access to healthcare. And so those who would be most affected by an unexpected pregnancy are also those most unlikely to have the resources to be able to get prompt abortion care. And so I think that we really run up into the problem, especially when we're talking about anti-abortion states, where those who want to have abortions in the first 12 weeks either don't have access because resource constraints or don't know that they're pregnant. The second problem in thinking about kind of child support and thinking about men's obligation is, again, thinking about how reproduction has been really central to women's subordination, not just in the United States, but in many countries for centuries. And so the question is not really one only of individual obligation, but one also of political status. I think that there are a lot of complicated issues in thinking about child support and thinking about financial obligations and how those are enforced. It's by no means straightforward that the way that states enforce them now is fair or equitable, but I think tying it specifically to abortion may create a whole new can of worms that we're not quite prepared to address.
We'll go to Margie in Milwaukee now. Margie, hello.
Hi. First of all, you asked how I felt, how we felt about abortion and if it made a difference. And I'm a progressive Democrat, so I would vote Democrat anyway. But the fact that the Republicans or the conservatives want to dictate a woman's right to her body, bodily autonomy, just infuriates me. And my question is, why is it always everything's on the woman? And, you know, the woman could go to the prison. The woman gets arrested. The doctor gets arrested. What about the man? And if this needs to be, I guess I'm wondering, do we need a national DNA list of, you know, have all men at the age of 18?
Margie, thanks for the call. I want to start with Margie's first point, Claire. Margie concerned, she says, about abortion laws as an infringement on bodily autonomy. And in some of the polling out there, some of the people who are voting based in part on abortion are saying it's about abortion and about freedom, limitations on freedom, especially for women. So Margie might be onto something there.
Absolutely. I think that it is pretty clear that when people think about abortion, they do think about this in the language of freedom. And in fact, many of the abortion referenda, Michigan's, California, Vermont's, all spoke in the language of either autonomy or freedom. And so this idea that one should not be coerced in carrying a pregnancy to term, I think resonates with people and how they think about the body as a space for freedom. I think it's something that deeply resonates with American political culture more broadly.
Thanks for the call, Margie. Claire, I wanted to talk a bit about your research. You've looked at abortion and politics for decades of American history, and you have a concern, at least in write-ups I've seen on your research, that the role of medicine and doctors and medical expertise gets kind of subordinated to politics. What do you see happening?
I think that when we think about abortion, you know, a couple of different things sometimes happen. One, we often stress the health aspects first and foremost. So you can actually see this a little bit in the Montana referendum, where, you know, the question was whether or not doctors would be required to provide life-sustaining measures if a child was born alive after an abortion. And this is often a technique to, again, create a kind of chilling process around abortion. But this is all over the kind of question of we need to regulate abortion as healthcare. And that oftentimes means that we aren't actually thinking about how abortion is meaningful for how people make sense of their own reproductive lives. And so when it becomes an issue about physicians and how they ought to determine what people's lives should look like, that's another way to kind of just say expertise should determine women's lives. One of the things that I think is really exciting about the referenda that we saw in Michigan, California, and Vermont is that because they're speaking in the language of reproductive freedom more broadly, it seems like we're seeing a shift where the question of where this fits into women and other pregnant people who can get pregnant lives, we see that as a way of kind of affirming this as a central part of their political membership, of even thinking about gendered citizenship more broadly. And so we're not necessarily speaking always in the language of medicine, even though if you turned on the news, you're often seeing these stories of people denied care in cases where their lives are in danger, or where we see cases of fetal non-viability, which again, speaks the language of medicine, not the language of autonomy or freedom, which is where I think that the abortion discourse really ought to be.
And in just our last few moments, the midterms answered some questions. There are a lot remaining. What are you watching for next?
I'm very interested in seeing how states come to codify these referenda. I'm also interested to see whether or not Democrats will continue to push for more protections of abortion in the future, and whether or not they will really kind of flip our traditional understanding of what it means to put abortion on the ballot. In the past, it's really been about how we see anti-abortion measures really kind of pushing elections. I wonder if we're going to see that totally flip and abortion becoming just a standard bearer of progressive politics in the future.
Claire, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary. Her research focuses on gender, politics, and reproduction in the United States. She was with us today to explore what the results from midterm elections could mean for abortion in the United States at the federal level and in states around the country. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the U.S. Supreme Court is weighing some cases related to anti-discrimination laws around the country. You can check out some of those cases and find out what's at stake, what precedents they could set, what arguments are being made on both sides. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Times change and time changes. We just adjusted our clocks over a week ago. If you didn't, you've been an hour early for a lot of stuff. Every 4 years, we have a leap year where we add a day to the year because our daily Earth calendar doesn't quite match up with the annual trip around the sun calendar. And I've mentioned a couple times in the past that scientists sometimes add a leap second. That's because the second was based on the Earth's rotation. Turns out the Earth is not a perfectly reliable clock. Now, we might be getting rid of the leap second. As reported in the New York Times, there is a super accurate atomic way to measure a second that always comes out the same, but the Earth's rotation speed varies a bit, slows down a tiny bit over time, so those two measurements get out of sync. Doesn't matter for most things, but with super accurate computer and GPS infrastructure, the difference matters. In a vote later this week, they may stop looking at the Earth's rotation, use that atomic clock, and get rid of the leap second. Will we notice? Probably not, but maybe you don't know what you got until it's gone. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a high school athlete working to break down barriers for girls in sports. Now, how easy is it for you to unplug, to clear your mind? It comes to some of us naturally. Others have to work at it. For example, the energetic overachiever Chris Traeger from NBC's sitcom Parks and Recreation.
Ron, you radiated mindfulness. What were you thinking about?
I wasn't thinking at all.
Incredible. It takes a ton of work for me to get to that kind of a clear headspace, no matter how hard I try.
Don't try so hard.
Don't try so hard. Ron, I'm going to try your not trying method right here, right now.
Our next guest, together with colleagues, saw a need for students at Lawrence University to have an opportunity to develop their own mindfulness and disconnecting skills. Constance Kasser is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Lawrence University, Chair of East Asian Studies there. She created a new course for this fall term. It's called Doing Nothing. Kati, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about the need you were trying to address in creating this new course at Lawrence?
Yeah, this course actually came out of a handful of conversations that some of my colleagues and I have been having over the course of the last few years. I mean, this even predates the pandemic. But one of the things that we were noticing was that our students seemed to increasingly not just have more stress and struggle with more mental health issues, but we were starting to notice that even when they weren't in class, they had a really hard time just relaxing. And I've heard from students again and again that they have trouble feeling okay, just letting themselves just kind of rest. And if they're not in class or working or doing homework or doing something that's going to go on their resume so that they can get a job after they graduate, they feel like they're wasting their time. So we really wanted to create something that would give students a little bit of permission to slow down and disconnect a bit.
Now, this could easily be a story about kids these days, but I'm a little older than your students. And I feel this sometimes. You know, I'm waiting at the bus stop and I pull out my phone because I don't know how to do nothing. I was just hanging out with my parents, and they are often in the same boat. This is about all of us. Why do we feel like we have to be constantly doing something as opposed to nothing?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a result of, at least in part, you know, our smartphones. We have these devices with us at all times that provide us with constant distraction, constant entertainment. And we've forgotten to a certain extent how to just stand in line and wait for the bus. And studies have shown that doing things like just allowing your mind to wander, being bored, or getting outside and taking a walk, you know, being in nature, meditating, all these sorts of things. We've seen studies that have shown that taking time to do these sorts of things can actually make you more productive in the rest of your day and less stressed and better able to function. So what we're really trying to do in this course is teach students skills to improve the other aspects of their lives.
Okay, I want to learn these skills too. What are some of the things that you and your colleagues are doing to help students disconnect and get some of that nothing time in?
Yeah. So, I mean, what's great about this course is every week is taught by a different member of our faculty or staff at Lawrence. And so folks are coming in and teaching either things that their own research and expertise is grounded in, or just skills that they have learned. So we had the very first week of class, Amanda Draheim, who's my colleague in the psychology department, came in and gave a lecture about the importance of sleep hygiene and having a sleep schedule. And she talked with students about the correlations that have been found between getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night and having a higher GPA. And so then she worked with students on setting goals for when are you going to go to bed? When are you going to get up? How are you going to ensure as a busy college student that you're going to get enough sleep every night? We had Linda Morgan Clement, who's our Dean of Religious and Spiritual Life. She practices Tai Chi. She came into class one day and taught us Tai Chi for an hour. We've had instructors in the dance department do mindful movement exercises with us. A colleague in the Spanish department took us for a walk on her favorite walk through Appleton down the Fox River. So we've done all sorts of different things in the class.
I understand this is like a one credit class. Students aren't getting, you know, 3-4 credits toward graduation from it. Did you see a hunger from students? Did you get a good response when people were signing up?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that's really kind of amazing about this class is at the beginning of the year, the registrar sent out a list of just the class tallies, you know, and how big each class was. And behind our course at Lawrence, first year studies, which the entire first year class has to take, the next biggest enrollment in the class was this Doing Nothing course, or in the university was this Doing Nothing course. So there's a real hunger there. We have more than 50 students enrolled, which at a small school like Lawrence is a pretty huge class.
And they're doing this, as I understand it, if I'm in this class, I leave my phone behind?
Yeah. So there's no homework. There's no final exam. but the requirements for the class are you show up, so you have to come to class, you participate to the best of your ability, and you don't use your phone. And that's actually been maybe one of the harder things for some of our students.
What's it, the class, I think, is just about wrapping up. What has been the response? What are you hearing from students involved?
The students who I've talked to have all had good things to say about the course. And they've told me that they've recommended it to their friends. We're going to offer it again in future terms at Lawrence. And, you know, one student said that, you know, when she leaves class and she goes and talks with her friends outside of class, she talks about what she learned in class. So I feel like that's a huge benefit, that the students who are in class are learning things and then they're going on and talking to their friends and their classmates about some of these skills that they're cultivating.
Now, this course has gotten attention, not just from WPR, but from local and even some national media as well. Were you surprised that this caught on?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I tweeted about it a couple of months ago and just, you know, said, I'm teaching this class. It's called Doing Nothing. And it's one of the highest enrolled classes at my university. And overnight, and the tweet wound up getting more than 130,000 likes or something like that. And then I was contacted by Time Magazine, and CNBC came and filmed our class. We even made it on Fox News. They had a kind of a different take on what we were doing in the class, but they didn't really take the time to understand what we were doing.
So if people are thinking, yeah, I do too much, I am too easily distracted, I don't just zone out, I don't like spend time in my own mind that often, could you leave us with some advice, some things we could try on our own time?
Yeah, I think, you know, this class that we're doing, we meet for 1 hour once a week. And for some students, that's actually proven to be too much. Some students have come to me and said, I have to drop the class because I'm too busy, which is kind of unfortunate. But I think, you know, even if you don't have an hour, even if you don't have, you know, 10 minutes in your day, I think one thing that can be really helpful is to, you know, the next time you are waiting for the bus or standing in line at the grocery store, don't pull out your phone right away. Just pause for a minute. Take three breaths. Just three breaths. Like, it doesn't have to be that long or that involved, but just take those three breaths and pay attention to your breathing. And I think that can drastically shift your frame of mind.
All right. Well, I have plans to be at a bus stop in a little while this evening. I'll give it a shot. Connie, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's Constance Kasser, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Lawrence University. We talked to her about the new course she created at Lawrence with some of her colleagues. It's called Doing Nothing. Hey, are you good at doing nothing, or do you find yourself always reaching for your phone or for something? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Why Wisconsin question about effigy mounds.
At one point in time, thousands of effigy mounds could be found in what is now called Wisconsin. These ancient burial sites are still significant to members of the state's First Nations. We recently received a question through the Wisconsin Project from a listener who wanted to know more about the effigy mounds. Liz Domes went to learn more about the people who created them.
The path winding around Lake Wissota in Chippewa Falls is thick with bugs and sweltering heat. About half a mile into a hike along the lake trail is a simple wooden fence and a sign. Hidden here under thick foliage is a mound that's more than 250 feet long. It was raised with soil 1,000 years ago to form the shape of a panther. It's an effigy mound, one of thousands across the state. Peter Crisco of Waniwok is curious about the sculptors who created these ancient mounds. He's a sculptor too, and nature is his biggest inspiration.
I would like to learn everything that I can about them and, you know, how it's connected to the human civilizations that lived here before and how they connected to spiritual world and how it all comes together. Because I think it's very relevant for our time because we are so disconnected from nature.
Amy Roseboro knows all about the mounds in Wisconsin. She's an archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society.
All right, so what is an effigy mound? An effigy mound is a burial mound made out of earth. It's a sculpture. It's a funerary monument.
That's Roseborough during a PBS Wisconsin University Place lecture in 2016.
Effigy mounds are unlike other mounds in that they're shaped like animals or spirits. It could be birds, could be bears, it could be even human form.
Their creations include the man mound in Baraboo, the double-tailed turtle in Madison, and the panther in Chippewa Falls.
And they're built by a group of people we call Late Woodland between AD 750 and 1200.
In a follow-up phone call with Roseborough, she says the Late Woodland people move dirt with wooden spades and digging sticks.
They are taking the dirt from a very shallow area. In other words, they're kind of scraping dirt so that the land will heal over very, very quickly. And they're not going to make a permanent alteration. They just want the mound to be there. That's it.
In her research, Roseborough found evidence of more than 3,100 effigy mounds in Wisconsin. It's estimated that there were many more than that, but there aren't records of them. Roseborough says about 90% of the effigy mounds once strewn across Wisconsin are now gone.
And once the area started to be settled and developed and colonized by Europeans, they plowed them under, they took them away for fill, they quarried, they built houses on top of them.
State law eventually protected these sites, first in the mid-1980s. Members of the Ho-Chunk Nation are fierce protectors of the mounds. They have long said that they're the descendants of the mound builders, and they've been very deliberate about what they share when it comes to these sacred sites.
The traditional court has told me upteen times that every time we expose this information, it gets sabotaged, ruined, or irreversibly damaged.
That's Samantha Skenendor. She's an attorney at Quarles and Brady and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. She spent almost two decades working with First Nations all over the country, helping to preserve cultural sites. She doesn't have authority to share the full story, but Skenendor did say that the mounds are a physical response to prayers of desperation sent by Ho-Chunk ancestors to their creator, Mauna.
They were lacking direction and foundation with themselves, their spirits. Wakan is our spirits. Our Wakan was lacking and needed support.
They prayed to Mauna, who promised to put medicine in the ground.
The Creator built them for us and had them rise up and show us who we are, where we're from, and that those will always be there for us.
The spirit of the effigies will take care of us, but we have to take care of them too.
WPR's Liz Domes brought us that story on effigy mounds. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a female football player for Pewaukee High School's team talks with us about what it's like to play on a mostly male team and why she's working to empower other girls and women to play in more sports. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. At Pewaukee High School, every senior on the football team started at least one game this year, and that includes senior Ava Matz, who took snaps as quarterback in the homecoming game there. She completed a 10-yard touchdown pass and worked to break down barriers for girls and women in sports. Ava Matz played free safety and quarterback for the Pewaukee High School's football team, the Pirates. She also plays basketball and softball. A senior at Pewaukee High School, she joins us from there right now. Ava, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Before we get to football, obviously sports are huge for you. How did you get so into sports?
I mean, I think my parents always had me in a sport at one age or another. And, you know, I like the busy lifestyle, but I'm also very competitive. That comes with everything, board games, anything. I love to compete.
Now, football, we've seen girls play usually on special teams at the high school level. What made you want to pursue, you know, playing positions, quarterback and safety?
You know, quarterback, my parents always told me I kind of had an arm, and at recess I'd always play with the boys, and I'd be like, yeah, like, this is something I wanted to do. And then freshman year, we kind of got to, like, pick our positions and stuff like that, and I was like, I'm going to rock it at quarterback. Like, I'm going to try it out and see how I do. And I stuck with it. Originally, I had started as an outside linebacker of my freshman year. That wasn't really the place for me. Sophomore year, I got moved to free safety, and I enjoyed it much more. It was just a better fit for me physically. And I helped lead the VR team my junior season and senior season. I was a leader to the young guys, kind of showing them the ropes and stuff like that, and making sure that there's people to fill the shoes when us seniors leave.
What kind of response did you get, especially from your teammates?
you know, at first I think they were a little unsure, like, why is she here? What is she looking to do? And you know what, as now seniors, all the boys, I share a ton of love for them. They respect me. They treat me so kindly. They make sure, you know, like I got taken down a couple times during the game. You know, they're right there to pick me back up, ask me if I'm doing okay. They're always there looking out for me, and I couldn't ask for another set of boys.
Now, you are in the books now. You have a touchdown completion to your name in that game. What was that moment like?
You know, it was a little scary. The play kind of, in reality, did fall apart, you know, but I put my trust in the boys, and, you know, I knew that Krzyzewski would take it all the way, and he, you know, it was second thought. He just did it, and he made it happen, so.
Now, yeah. This is part of a wider effort for you, not just for yourself, but for other girls maybe coming up into high school to try. Maybe it's not football, but to try sports and maybe ones that girls don't think about pursuing. What is your message to them if they're listening right now or their parents are listening right now?
I think my message is always like try hard. You know, if you have a big dream, you know, always follow it. My big dream was to play football, and, you know, I stuck with it and I followed it, and, you know, I couldn't be more happy with the decision I made. You know, you have dreams because it's something you want to pursue and it's something you're interested in. And, you know, you have to take risks and you're going to make mistakes, but in the end, that just makes you a better person, a better player, better athlete. And it's so amazing to see other girls out there. You know, when we were playing our homecoming game, there was actually another girl on the other team. And after the game, she came up and talked to me and was like, "You're so inspiring." And I think, like, I'm not the only one that's doing it, but to see that we can inspire others to do it makes it all the more worth it.
Talking to Pewaukee High School senior Ava Matz, athlete in multiple sports, basketball, softball, and on the football team. Ava, as I mentioned, you are a senior now. Do you have a vision for what you want to do athletically after you graduate?
Yeah, my plans are to get accepted into UW-Madison and row on the Badgers rowing team for the women's team.
Have you done crew? Have you done rowing before?
I have never done it before, so it's going to be a completely new experience. But, you know, I think being well-rounded in athletics, each sport's different. You know, football, basketball, softball, each of them are a little bit different. And I think it'll help out and be in my favor.
Now, what's three sports? You never really have a rest period, right? Could you talk about your workload being in three sports, all of which have fairly intensive training regimens?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, football starts right away in the summer. So, you know, like once school ends, we get a week off, and then we have like the off season conditioning, strength training, everything like that. And typically, well, like last year, since we went to state, you know, I missed the first 2 weeks of basketball season. This week, we unfortunately lost in level two. So I had a week off, took that time to rest, heal up. And now we're into basketball season. We're on week two. And then right after that, it's softball. It's never ending. It's so busy. But I feel like I thrive with a busy schedule. I love to be around my teammates. They make me a better person, better student.
Can you talk about that that social connection value that you get out of sports? That's something that I think people don't always think of as we're just watching the game on the field.
Yeah, I mean, having teammates, you know, like there's solo sports out there, but most of my success comes from my teammates, you know, like pushing me at practice, pushing me in the weight room, you know, pushing me to be a good student too, you know, like they hold me accountable. And I think that's helped me be so successful in sports and in schools. They hold me accountable and I hold them accountable. And, you know, from there, you only take steps off each other. You grow and you just make this friendship and pretty much a family. You become a family with your teammates because you care for their successes. They care for yours. And it's really important to have teammates that support you and that are looking to help you.
And I should ask, I know you played quarterback and free safety on the football team. What are your positions in basketball and softball?
Basketball, the past couple years, I've kind of been playing a post role, but this year we're like, everybody's kind of like wings, guards, stuff like that. And in softball, I play first base.
All right, Ava, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the next steps in your athletic career.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Been talking to Ava Matz, a senior at Pewaukee High School who played this season on her school's football team. She opened as the quarterback for Pewaukee's homecoming game this season, has a touchdown completion to her name. Ava joins us to talk about playing as a woman on an all-male team and why she wants to help encourage other women to check out a wider variety of sports. Hey, if you have a story about your athletic career, on a boys team or a girls team or a co-ed team. Love to hear about it. Been thinking about doing an open call-in on athletics. It's been quite a while. Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Also tomorrow, we'll talk with the author of a new book on friendships among sports fans. Turns out that sports fans, in some cases, have more friends than non-fans. So we'll look at the social connection that comes out of athletics. You can share your story with us right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Sports fans, I love them. Do you too? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Also coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll break down the midterm elections, what happened that we expected to happen in Wisconsin, what may have moved away from expectations. We've got Craig Gilbert, longtime reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, to bring us the demographics, what happened by region, what swayed the election one way or another. Plus, stop and listen to the birds and watch them and take your time about it. We'll talk to the author of a new book that makes the case for slow birding. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.